Next speaker is Jeff Volt. Jeff Volt's presenting on how 90.1 will affect healthcare facilities. Jeff is the Director of Engineering at JKWW Engineering. He's a voting member of ASHRAE SSPC 90.1. He's a voting member of, he's a member of Standards Committee 90.1, the Mechanical Subcommittee, Chair of the Working Groups for Healthcare, Hydronics, Elevators, Duct Leakage, and Drive Systems. He's also a member of 90.1, Work Group for Radiant Heating, Cooling, and Heat Recovery. He's a member of the Advanced Energy Design Guide for Small Healthcare Facilities. Jeff?
Thank you, Ron. So if any of you want a copy of the slides, you can get it at the address after my email. But what I really recommend to you is buy the DVD from the that concludes all the seminars from this weekend's presentations. And I think in Montreal, I'll probably be presenting about how you can find what you want in all those DVDs, because they're a wonderful resource, especially when you get a project your company's never designed before, and you can find about 10 good seminars about how to design it, which is something I'm working on for ASHRAE right now, is cataloging all that stuff. So anyway, get the DVD. Normally I do this as about an hour and a quarter, maybe an hour talk, so you're not going to learn about why you care about 90.1 and how it's enforced, because I figure if you're an ASHRAE person, you probably already know that stuff. But I'm going through 60 slides in 20 minutes, so don't blink, you'll miss something. I'm going to talk about what changed, what kind of challenges you're going to have, some ideas about how you might want to comply, you know, at the lowest cost or the best life cycle cost for your clients, and some resources for more information. So what changed? Probably the biggest single change is the scope of 90.1. 90.1 now can regulate industrial processes. Now, it doesn't mean it applies to all industrial processes. It means that if we specifically say in 90.1 that we know enough about this kind of process to regulate it, we can bring it into 90.1. And in the 2010 version, there is just one of those, and that one is data centers, or you might call them computer rooms. And probably the big requirement that was added for that is a requirement for economizer. It can be airside or waterside, but there is a requirement for economizers in the 2010 version for data centers. There are some exceptions, particularly for some of the really, really critical data centers. 90.1 2010 does not apply to the data center that launches anti-missile missiles, and it doesn't apply to the ones that handle the Wall Street financial transactions, at least between the major banks. But most data centers it would cover. So what happened? We issued the 2010 version. We finished all our work. I'm getting ahead of myself. But our goal from DOE was to get to 30% energy savings compared to 90.1 2004. Now, 2007 only saved a couple percent. So pretty much we were trying to take 30% in one jump. And I didn't go through the politics part about 90.1, but you can be pretty sure that the IECC will incorporate most of the changes in 90.1 into their prescriptive path. They already voted recently that 90.1 2010 will be an alternative path in the 2012 IECC. So for most of you, that's probably when it'll become code and start to really affect your lives. Although if you're doing LEED, my bet, and since we're in Vegas, I'd take money on this one, LEED will jump up to the 2010 pretty soon. 2010 is intended to be a code minimum standard. LEED is intended to be a step beyond. For them not to jump up to the 2010 would be kind of out of character. So we did our final voting in Albuquerque at the end of June. In the end, following that, two of our proposals were kind of shot down in public appeal to the board of directors of ASHRAE. I think there were six appeals, two of which were upheld, and I'll go through those. We did a lot of changes in 2010. I wrote addendum DF as part of the elevator working group that I chair, and DF means we went all the way through A, B, C, D, E, then we did AA, AB, AC, then we did BA, BB, BC. So we went through the alphabet 4.5 times, writing addendum and getting them passed, not counting the ones that failed. So 90.1 cuts the country up into 9 temperature zones. Trust me, way up there in the north, there's something numbered 9. I think the U.S. only goes as far as 8. And into 3 humidity zones, A, B, and C. I'm from Wisconsin, so everybody I know is in climate zone A, which means moist. We have humid summers. B is people with drier summers, primarily the western U.S. And C is marine environments, where it's hard to tell the water from the sky. So first one I'm going to go over, I'm going to kind of start with architectural things. This is one of them that got turned over in appeal. And this is Addendum BB, which is probably the biggest thing the envelope subcommittee did. And it made huge changes to the R values and the amount of glass you were allowed to have in buildings and the shading coefficients. And unfortunately, all those eggs were in one basket. And when two parts of it got shot down in appeal, the whole thing went down. But just to give you an example, in my climate zone in Madison, Wisconsin, it would take us from R, I'm talking about just a metal stud wall as an example, it would take us from R13 in the stud space plus 7.5 inches of 7.5 R value of continuous insulation, which would be like 2 inches of beadboard if you're doing an EIFS system or something like that, to R15 continuous insulation on that wall, which would move you to a 4 inch. In fact, going a little bit north of Wisconsin, you get beyond 4 inches, and it becomes illegal to put that much foam on the exterior of a building. You have to think of some way to not put it on the exterior, at least not put all of it on the exterior. So anyway, that's not in 2010, but it's going to come back in some form in 2013. We've already voted the first chunk of that through the committee. It slightly toned down. Another part of that addendum that went away and is going to, at least it's going to be, there are going to be attempts to bring it back, is we lowered the maximum glazing percentage from 40% that you're allowed today, and still in the 2010 because it was shot down, to 30%. Because to do daylighting, you don't need more than 30%. If you've seen some of the net zero office building prototypes and things like that, they always end up about 15 to 20% glazing. Another one that's not in there that I'm trying hard to get in the 2013 is envelope continuity. And for those of you who work a lot in healthcare, at least if you work in a cold climate like me, you see this all the time. Windows that sweat and clients that have the choice between either complying with the FGI guidelines and having 30% humidity or having windows that don't have water running off them in all winter. And the most common reason I see for that happening is the windows get pushed out beyond the insulation layer, like you see in this picture on the left. The windows are out over the face brick in this wall, and every time those windows sweat. And I'm trying to get a proposal through that the window, which is the R value layer here, needs to be at least contiguous with your other R value layers, or you need to extend the insulation sideways. I'm kind of tired of being told that I'm supposed to blow hot air on the windows and increase the heat transfer to stop them from sweating. So anyway, some things that did pass. Building envelope air barriers. There is a requirement for air barriers in all buildings in the 2010 standard. And there are two methods of compliance for your architectural partners. They can either detail the air barrier, and that what that means is they have to have a section, and they have to say, in this wall section, this item is my air barrier. And it has to be an item that has a certain level of air leakage or less. The other option is you can say, I don't feel like doing all that work and pressure test the building. And the reason I included this slide is I don't want to be the architect that designed a million square foot healthcare facility and it failed the pressure test. Because at that point, you get on your cell phone and you call up a trucking company and tell them you need one of those milk tankers full of caulk. I think the designing it out is the right method to do it. Okay, another one that affects the architects. There's finally passive solar in 90.1. And it requires more south-facing glazing than you have either east-facing or west-facing glazing. And this is going to affect more people than architects. This is going to affect people like campus planners when you start thinking about how this works. There are some exceptions. I mean, if you're in downtown New York on the first level and you're blocked by a whole bunch of high-rise, it doesn't make much sense. Storefront, infill with nearby buildings, alterations. If you've got an existing building, you know, normally you're supposed to come up to 90.1 if you do a major alteration. We're not going to make you spin the building around or something like that. But let's think about the practical implications of this. South is defined as plus or minus 45 degrees, the red lines in this diagram. East and west are designed as plus or minus 30 degrees. That was one thing I was fairly vehement. Originally it was 45 degrees and 45 degrees, so if you tilted your building 1 degree, a whole bunch of glass changed from wonderful to awful. And I don't think it's that way, so we created kind of a demilitarized zone between the good glass and the bad glass. But when you think about it, when you're laying out a building, imagine that's the footprint you've got planned, and you're trying to comply with this standard, and you've got to get more glass. You can't have any more glass in the east or west than you can put on the south. You know, so think about which way you're going to orient your building. That's what they're trying to get people to do, is lay their buildings out east-west like a true passive solar building should be, because it just plain lowers your energy use. Another one for those of you in the southern climates, cool roofs are a requirement in climate zones 1 through 3, so I think that doesn't get as far north as St. Louis, but pretty close to that far. There are now requirements for skylights and daylighting in the standard. I didn't go into those, but up until the 2010 version, there were no requirements for daylighting. There are now four addendum that address daylighting. There are a whole bunch of diagrams. I'm not going to go into this because it's a group of engineers. And as far as skylighting, in a room like this, if we were on the top floor of this building, it would require a small amount of skylighting in it. So if you're just walking through the room, you don't have to turn on all these lights to get from one end to the other. It's not a major requirement, but in terms of how much area it is, but it requires a little bit if you're in the top floor and you're a tall room. Okay, I'm going to go through mechanical requirements, which is what most of you are probably interested in. VAV, you know, we've always had the fan horsepower limitations, and that, for those of you in healthcare, that's probably the toughest requirement in 90.1 2007 for you to meet. I've had people call me and tell me it's physically impossible, but I know the last major, about 750,000 square foot healthcare facility we did met prescriptively and was actually 10% under. So it can be done, Michael. But approximately, if by the time you add in all the credits that you get for ducted return and filters and blah, 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 for an average office building, you're probably going to get 1.5 horsepower per 1,000 CFM. So if you've got a 10,000 CFM system, you might get a 10 horsepower supply fan and a 5 horsepower return fan, probably a little less because your exhaust fans have to count into it, and any series powered VAV boxes, anything that runs when you're at full cooling load. For a hospital, you're probably going to get more like 2.3 brake horsepower per 1,000 CFM because you've got a ducted return, you've got higher levels of filtration, you've got some other things that you get credit for. And that's probably the biggest difference between, if you go back as far as, I think, 2004, maybe even a little earlier, there weren't all these credits, and a hospital only got the same credit amount of horsepower as an office building. It was really bad because you couldn't build a hospital. So now I would say 90% of the designers base their design on brake horsepower. There is still the option for nameplate horsepower, but the brake horsepower one is almost always a little more generous to you, and it actually equates to the load you're actually having. Also, the fan requirements are in the 2009 IECC, and I'm sure continuing into 2012, so it's actually like the law, so engineers finally have to do it. After 2010, there probably by the 2013 will be some kind of drive efficiency requirements, because right now, the loss in, say, the belt system, it's a belt-driven fan, doesn't count. You just take the brake horsepower off the fan, and never mind that you lost 5% in between there. So we're starting to look at that. Another thing with the fan power is, right in the 2007 version of 90.1, if you have an energy recovery unit, you're allowed to add how much ever horsepower it takes to drive the air through that. I had a big problem with that, because I've seen some of these things so undersized that they had so much static pressure through them, they used more fan power than they saved in enthalpy, but B, I actually saw one that was so undersized it was tilted sideways and quit spinning. So that's not good. So we wanted to encourage people that if they're putting in energy recovery units, to put in bigger ones, because if they're bigger, there'll be lower velocity through them, they'll use less air pressure drop, and the efficiency will go up, so it's a double win. So what we did is we wrote a linear equation and said how much horsepower credit you get depends on how efficient your energy recovery wheel is. So if somebody could do a 100% efficient one, which nobody makes, you'd get 1.7 inches equivalent, I guess I'd call it, of horsepower for your fan. And if you only barely met the minimum of 50%, you'd only get 0.6 inches of credit. Okay. Is this microphone working? Doing anything? Okay, we'll see how close I can get it. Anything? A little bit. Okay, good. I can quit shouting. And if you just did the bare minimum, you'd only get 0.6 inches. So also, if you do a generously sized energy recovery unit, besides saving more energy and using less horsepower, you get more horsepower allowance for your fan. So it makes it a lot easier to meet your fan requirements. And you'll see a little later you're going to have to do them anyway. Suggestions for compliance with this, because this is the hardest one to meet still. Keep your system static low. I mean, pick an efficient fan. Actually, we're working on that right now. There's work on an addendum for minimum fan efficiencies. But still, keep your static pressure down. I tell my clients that under the new code, you're going to get a bigger air handling unit box with a smaller motor inside of it, because we want to keep that velocity down through the coils and filters so you have low pressure drop through the air handler. So bigger box, smaller motor. Minimize your duct turns. When you do a static pressure calculation and you add all these things up and you start talking about friction factor, it's kind of penny ante. all your pressure drop is coming from those big elbows at 2,000 foot a minute that are chewing up a quarter or a 3/8 of an inch of static pressure each. So get in early and get a duct system that's short and straight, and you won't have trouble meeting the fan power requirements. You know, I think sometimes as engineers we need to be better politicians or salespeople. I have never had trouble going into a project early on, if I remember to go down there early on, and talking to an architect and saying, hey, I want my air handling unit here. And if you let me put it here, well, A, I'll meet the energy code. You know, B, I won't use so much horsepower. You know, you want to be a green building. All the architects I know are into that stuff. C, my ducts will be shorter. And short ducts are cheap ducts. And that means you might be able to afford that marble lobby. And short ducts take up less volume in the room. So maybe you can have some of those 10-foot ceilings as they get a little farther from the shafts. You know, I think we need to sell this stuff because you can get what you want to. I worked on a project where we came in and we laid out an air handling system just exactly where we wanted it and sat down with the developer and the architect, and general contractor turns to the mechanical sub, and the mechanical sub says, take $2 a square off my GMP. You know, I mean, it comes back to you in money if you can get it in early. Once the floor plans are done, you're sunk. Next, energy recovery. The current requirement I've got in red there is if you're over 70% outside air and you're over 5,000 CFM, you need energy recovery. Well, that's not many buildings. In the new standard, it's almost all the buildings those of us who are engineers are doing. For example, in my climate zone 5A, if I'm doing a building with 30%, well, let's say 31% outside air, above 5,500 CFM, I've got to have energy recovery. So, you know, unless you're getting down into pretty small stuff, you're going to have energy recovery under the new standard, and even in zones pretty far south. So the economics just paid off for it. Next, I'm going to talk about reheat. I mean, this is a healthcare seminar, and this is an energy model my firm did, but it's very typical of the work we've been getting from PNNL and NREL on healthcare facilities. Reheat is the biggest piece of the pie in your energy use. And this doesn't count your heating coil, your preheat coil. This is just the reheat for the air you already paid to cool. Or the air that you, quote, free-cooled with an economizer and then fired up a Scotch Marine steam boiler to rehumidify it. So anyway, you know, 2007, the big loophole for healthcare was if you had a pressure-controlled, at least one pressure-controlled room on the air handler, you could fit into that exception that says you can do all the reheat you want to. I mean, that's how a lot of people will still today do a constant volume reheat hospital. I think California is all going that way. A lot of the East Coast is that way. In the Midwest, we're mostly VAV. I think almost everybody's doing VAV. And there were a lot of other exceptions for reheat. And the IECC is a little less restrictive than ASHRAE. So reheat's pretty prominent in hospitals. And that pie graph I showed you earlier was a VAV one, not like a constant volume one, which is way worse. So in 2010, the requirements changed, and they say, we got rid of almost all the exceptions that let you do reheat. The only two that are left are up to 30% of your peak flow. So if you have 1,000 CFM in a room, you can reheat 300. And the other one is flow up to that required air changes that you have. And required is defined as required by a code or required by an accreditation standard. So for example, if you're doing a patient room, FGI guidelines say 6 air changes. You can reheat 6 air changes, fine. But if you need 10 air changes to meet the cooling load, you're a VAV system because you can only reheat 6. So I would say in most healthcare facilities, this means constant volume is dead if you're complying with 90.1 2010. And it's a huge energy savings going to VAV in healthcare. The one person I think is going to have issues with this maybe is probably the lab people more than the hospitals. Because hospitals get their 6 air changes, their 15 or 20 air changes in their ORs because of the FGI guidelines or their state accreditation. A lot of the labs don't have that. You know, your health and safety officer saying you need 10 air changes doesn't quite cut it by the wording. So there might be a market out there for Jim Bob's lab accreditation service. Another big savings in healthcare is your operating rooms, because the only requirement in standard 170 and therefore the FGI guidelines for airflow is when you're occupied, I think 20 air changes is the current one in standard 170, but when you're unoccupied, you're only required to maintain positive pressure. And when we did the Advanced Energy Design Guide for small healthcare, that bumped us from a 30% savings guide to beyond 40%, all but one climate zone. It was that big a difference to these clinics and surgical centers. One thing that we probably will come back with in 2013 is leakage testing for operating rooms and pressure-controlled spaces, because we got some data back from people who actually test these, do blower door tests on ORs, and they varied from about 400 CFM to maintain the pressure the code requires to about 1,950, which would be like full flow with no return. So we're going to try to limit how much they leak, because it'll save a lot of energy. And you probably don't want that leaky one anyway, because it's hard to make your air handler work when it's got no return air coming back. Another limitation to reheat, if you're doing overhead air heating, the air coming out of that diffuser can't be more than 20 degrees above room temperature. A lot of people argued for 15 to match standard 62 and that sort of stuff, but those of us in the north realized that would require every building to have fin tube or something. So for a lot of spaces, though, if your envelope isn't good, you're going to have either radiant ceiling panels or fin tube or something other than the overhead air or a fan-powered box to bring that temperature down, which actually does save energy. But I would argue that you might want to talk to your architectural friends and say, I can get rid of that ugly fin tube you don't want if you just build me an envelope with enough R value I don't have to put the air out above 20 degrees above space temperature. It might be a cheaper way to design the building, actually, and people will be more comfortable. So suggestions for compliance. Perimeter heating in a lot of buildings, probably not as big healthcare, can be a big energy savings because people can walk in and turn on their heat without turning on the air handler and reheating 50 other rooms. Condenser reheat is what I'm going to talk about a little bit further, is one way to really save on your reheat. And of course you can go to DOAS systems, you know, with heat pumps. We've done two pond source geothermal hospitals now, and they do use a heck of a lot less energy. But not every client wants that. There's certainly more maintenance involved in that kind of distributed system. I'm going to talk about economizers next. 2007, there were a lot of exemptions. In fact, healthcare was exempt. Because if you had to humidify above a 35 degree dew point, which is about 22% at normal temperatures, you were exempt from having an economizer. So for the last, you know, 10 years, healthcare hasn't been required to have an economizer in 90.1. Also, you had exemptions for any building that was above 5 or 11 tons, depending on your climate zone, and you were exempt anywhere south of about St. Louis. So in 2010, which is the blue at the bottom, and this has passed now. I'm sorry, I've got it still in blue text, but this went through. Economizers are in all zones except 1A and 1B. So for those of you in Mississippi who aren't used to having economizers, you've got them now. And above 54,000 BTUs, so pretty small. That's 4.5 tons. We're actually even a little more restrictive than that in Wisconsin, going even a little lower than that for some equipment. So economizers were one of the biggest savings in 90.1 in the energy model, and even in the southern states, although there's a lot of controversy about how to control them. There also is a requirement, I've got a slide missing here, but for in certain cases where healthcare would have to go to waterside economizer because of all the energy you spend rehumidifying the air. In most cases, you're going to get out of it, and I think it's going to be a kind of a temporary requirement because FGI guidelines are dropping to 20%. So, but watch out in that window there. I mean, you can save a substantial amount of money with a water economizer, but a lot of clients might not want it because a maintenance guy's worst nightmare is freezing up that tower on the roof. And finding out he has no way to cool his facility if he has a control malfunction. But they do save a lot of energy. And let's face it, the data center people who are really into never having downtime, that's what they're doing is waterside economizer. I'll have a couple slides about that a little later. That's on that same talk. If you're doing a waterside economizer, you have to satisfy 100% of the expected load at 45 degrees dry bulb, 40 degree wet bulb. That's actually required. In some cases, that will be what determines the size of your cooling towers when you're doing water economizer. They don't perform, you don't get the kind of approach at cold temperatures that you do at warm temperatures out of a cooling tower. So I'm going to talk a little bit, just real quickly, out of economizer. And this is actually a snapshot out of the Advanced Energy Design Guide for Small Healthcare, which this is actually something I wrote for that guide. But I did a quick energy comparison of a 10,000 CFM system at 30 degrees outside air. And I said, well, what if I've got no economizer? And I went through all the math and said, you can use 148,000 BTUs per hour at that condition. And then I said, if I put in an air economizer, well, I don't spend any cooling energy, but I do spend some humidification energy, but still, it cuts my energy use to about a third. So air economizer is a good deal. I mean, you still spend some money in humidifying it, but it's better than not having an economizer by far. So then I looked at water economizer. So I get rid of most of that humidification. I still have to humidify the minimum outside air amount, but drops down to 27,000 BTUs per hour. And then I looked at condenser reheat, where you're actually using a smaller chiller and you're pumping the heat to, say, 130, 140 degrees to do your reheating. And that actually shows up as negative numbers because of where I started my baseline, because you're getting more heat and cooling out of it than you're putting in electricity. But anyway, I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. But condenser reheat, we're finding in healthcare facilities in Wisconsin, which is not the best place from an economic standpoint, we're getting three and a half year straight line payback on doing heat recovery chiller for doing condenser reheat. And this is my slide that I use to explain to architects what condenser reheat is. So a normal healthcare facility, you got your cooling tower running, you've got your chiller running, and you've got your boiler running all at the same time all summer. In theory, if you were in load balance, what you'd actually run with condenser reheat is your chiller. And it would make your hot water make your cold water for your coil to dehumidify. Now, you're never in good balance like that. So your boiler's probably running, and maybe your cooling tower is too. But the point is, you know, you're putting in energy like a heat pump. And from an economic standpoint, the easiest way for me to explain it is, in today's economy, in most parts of the USA, your chiller can make your reheat water cheaper than your boiler can. And just think of the chilled water as free. That's about what the economics are like. We're seeing people that run them all winter just for the reheat, even though they don't have a use for the cooling, because it's cheaper. Now, it depends on your utility rates. But that's a big one that I think we're going to try to get into 90.1 this time around. There are a lot of ifs and buts. It pays in healthcare, office building, probably not. Building in a lab, it'll probably pay in, because you've got those high minimum airflow rates, so you're forced to do reheat all year round. The last one we commissioned in the winter, it turned out the MRIs didn't have as much load as we thought, and it didn't make the kind of payback we were hoping for, but in the summer, it blew the doors off what we analyzed. So it's probably more like 2.5 years in that case. Duct sealing is the next thing I'm going to talk about. We moved everything to Class A. There, when I went through the economic analysis, there were a couple of cases, like downstream of a VAV box exposed in the room, where you couldn't pay off seal Class A, but we got rid of a whole huge table, and there were only a couple of cases where it didn't pay back. And along with that, shaft openings should have bushings. I don't know how many of you have ever seen jobs where they put these residential volume dampers in that have a straight shaft in a round hole with no bearing at all, and the air just is leaking out everywhere. That's not allowed anymore in 90.1. Leak testing, 25% of duct systems over 3 inches. Now, that's the same as in 2007. But what we added is all outdoor ductwork. I mean, a lot of you have seen some of these California studies about how terrible outdoor ductwork is and stuff like that. We said if you're going to run it outdoors across the roof, you're going to leak test it. The other thing we added is which test sections get tested is chosen by the owner. So Mr. Contractor can't put in 25% of the ductwork really good and then tell his guys build it like normal. And we went to leakage class 4 for everything. Now, most engineers understand seal class but not leak class. Leakage class 4 means 100 square foot of duct at 1 inch pressure at 1 inch of pressure would leak 4 CFM. And seal class and leak class are different. Your specs really should call out a leakage class if you're going to do a test, because there's nothing that says seal class A leaks this and seal class B leaks that. There's some guidance in the SMACNA leak test manual, but not anything black and white that says what they have to test to. But the difference here is right now in SMACNA's stuff, they suggest 6 for rectangular and I think 3 for round. We took them both to 4 and leveled the playing field. So that was a compromise. The round guys wanted us to test every single duct on the project and bring the numbers down to 2. The rectangular guys wanted to leave a differential and so forth, so we compromised. A couple other things. I'm only going to talk about a few of these, but 90.1-2010 now requires pump head calculations. I got 2 public review comments saying that was an unreasonable burden on the engineering community. I think I'm doing too much work when I do buildings, but I actually took a poll I think it was in Salt Lake City, of engineers. It was very unscientific. I just asked about 10 guys. I got 1/4 of the people say they run a spreadsheet like my firm does to calculate the pump head. 1/2 said I figure the length to the end of the system multiplied by my friction factor, add 50% for the fittings, and double it for coming back. And 1/4 said I'm the god of engineering. I put my thumb up in the air and I know what it's going to be. Another one, radiant panel insulation. We now require what amounts to at least 1 inch of R4 insulation on the back of any radiant ceiling panel or any radiant panel, not including radiant slabs. And that's because if you look at how those things are rated, they're rated on the water side. So when you test them, the less insulation you put on them, the more BTUs you get out of them because it goes out the top. And so you can print a bigger number. So we're requiring insulation on the back side of those. And I've had a job where the ceiling plenum was about 110 degrees and the room wasn't very warm. So that's necessary. Supplier temperature reset was one of the biggest ones. And I know healthcare is sometimes a little bit afraid of this, but even resetting 5 degrees is a huge savings on your reheat and can be a great payback for your owners. Data centers use 2% of the U.S. electric energy today. That's why we added data centers into the standard, and it's actually going up pretty fast. We now have a very loose requirement for these VRF, I think I'm supposed to say, systems. It's not very tight because they've never been certified before. I expect, like most products that get certified, their efficiency numbers will drop somewhat once they're certified. Everybody else's did. There were 30 lighting addenda. Only two of them affected the watt power you're allowed per square foot. The rest were all control. So the big message to you who are mostly mechanical engineers is there are going to be a lot more switches on the wall, a lot more motion sensors, a lot more devices controlling those. So we said the lumen density is about as low as we can get it and have people happy. Now let's get the lights off. You can see here, hospitals actually went up a hair, clinics went down. No daylighting rules until 2010. Now there are four different requirements about it, lots of diagrams and stuff. Outdoor lighting got split into four zones. A national park should probably be darker than Las Vegas. Lots and lots of shutoff. By level, a lot of rooms now, you walk into them, they can come back on automatically, but only to half light level or lower. So if you've got a three-lamp fixtures in a building, the middle one will come back on the motion sensor. The outer two cannot. You have to go over and push the button if you want all full lighting level. And a lot of spaces, they can't come back on automatically at all. That's the difference between an occupancy sensor and a vacancy sensor. I didn't know there was a difference. This one was overturned. We tried to make people measure their total electricity, their HVAC electricity, their receptacle electricity, all these things separately. In some form, it'll come back, but I think it'll only be total building measuring. This one did pass. 50% of your 120-volt receptacles need to be switched in some manner. It can be motion sensor, can be time of day, what can be whatever you think up. There are a lot of exceptions for that, including for healthcare. Equipment that's supposed to run 24 hours is accepted. Spaces where patient care is rendered, we don't want grandma's ventilator going off. Spaces where automatic shutoff would be dangerous. Booster pumps, there are finally rules about booster pumps. I went after some of these things like booster pumps and elevators because if we don't get the plug load down, we're never going to meet these goals of X percent reduction when 30% of it we can't touch. I did find out that the engineer's dream booster pump that has everything is the one that uses the most energy. So we basically said if nobody's using water, it should go off, which doesn't happen if all you put on is a variable frequency drive and control it off a sensor, like some of the homemade ones. And that you couldn't have a PRV at the pumps. You can still have one on every floor, but you can't take all the water up to 170 PSI then reduce it to 140 right on the spot. And one way or another, you should be able to sense the flow as if you can either put your sensor out at the end of the system, or you can have some kind of a logarithm that figures out how much flow and varies the set point depending on the flow through the pump. Elevators, we said at least 35 lumens per watt averaged over the fixtures in the elevator. So you could do a couple of MR lamps and some T8s and mix and match, and as long as you get under 35 lumens per watt, or you could do all LEDs. Ventilation, that one's easy to meet. We said the fans and lights have to go off after 15 minutes of no activity in the elevator. That's actually the biggest savings, because most elevators, they run 24/7. And I'll argue that if you've been in an elevator for 15 minutes without pushing a button, you're kind of probably hoping the lights go off. Do you want to go farther? Michael was talking about 189.2 in the case of healthcare, or 189.1. Although I have to say, 90.1's energy modeling actually landed a percent or two better than 189's did. But 189 adds a lot of things besides energy into it. And I'm sure they'll tighten it up. VAV complies, but unless you're doing condenser reheat, you won't make big lead energy points when they move up to the 2010 standard. You're going to have to do condenser reheat. The only way I know with VAV that you'll make big energy points. You want to look at some more options? Look at the Advanced Energy Design Guides. The healthcare and all of them are a free download. Just type in AEDG and you'll find them all. They're a good cookbook. I think LEED is giving one energy point for anybody who follows the Advanced Energy Design Guide series in that. We're just starting work on the large healthcare Advanced Energy Design Guide. They're just putting the committee done they've got the energy model. This is a facility we did in the St. Louis area that they used as the baseline for it, that they thought was pretty average number of ORs per square foot and all that sort of thing. So where'd we end up in 90.1? After all that, never mind the left-hand column, because they did finally decide that we should be using 62.1 2007 for comparison. These numbers are a little bit old. They're actually 25.5 or 24, maybe it is, including the plug load, and just a little over 30 excluding the plug load. So they're pretty close to what we ended up with there. So depending on how you count the numbers, we made our 30% goal. And we set the goals for 2013, which are 40% total building, 50% if you exclude the plug loads. And the bottom line, which facility do you want to own? You know, the white is the savings, you know, from doing all these energy things in 90.1 and beyond in this case. But, you know, the whole goal is to save energy, not just to comply with the code. So I'm sorry I ran a little bit late here. Are there any quick questions? Or you want me to hand you this one?
I'm sorry.
This one work? No, this one doesn't work. No. Questions? Thank you, Jeff.